this is Danielle Fisher. Welcome to Melanoma Insights for Professionals, brought to you by Melanoma Institute Australia. In today's podcast, we're exploring diagnostic uncertainty in the context of cutaneous melanoma. Some melanocytic lesions are diagnostically challenging for pathologists as they have features that don't typically fit with the diagnosis of a benign nevus, while also not reaching diagnostic criteria for melanoma. This uncertainty can have significant impact on the patient, including suboptimal management pathways, poor patient well-being, inappropriate healthcare resource allocation, and ultimately poor outcomes for patients. Join us as we explore the significance of addressing diagnostic uncertainty and the strategies clinicians employ to ensure accurate melanoma diagnoses to ultimately improve healthcare practices and patient outcomes. Leading our discussion today is Dr. Adrian Quek. Adrian is a skin cancer GP at MIA and Chatswood Skin Cancer Clinic. We'd also like to welcome Associate Professor Robin Saw. Robin is a general surgeon at MIA, head of department in melanoma and surgical oncology at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, and an associate professor in surgery at the University of Sydney. We also have Dr. Andrew Colback in the studio today. Andrew is a staff specialist in anatomical pathology at the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital. And joining us via Zoom today is Professor Peter Sawyer. Peter is the chair in dermatology at the University of Queensland and director of the Dermatology Research Centre there too. He's also an EU board-certified dermatopathologist. Welcome to you all, and thank you for taking time out of your busy roles to join us for this discussion. Before we dive in, I just want to take a moment to invite you to join our 2024 Australasian Melanoma Conference to be held in Sydney on the 25th and 26th of October 2024. Many of the world-leading experts we feature on this podcast series will be presenting at this conference, as it's hosted by Melanoma Institute Australia. To find out more, please visit melanoma2024.com. Let's get started then. We're looking at the topic of melanocytic lesions that are difficult to classify as either benign or malignant. These may be discussed using a variety of terms. Adrian, perhaps you could introduce the topic for us.
Thank you, Danielle. We're talking about the topic of uncertainty in the context of borderline pathology. And I think we need to acknowledge right at the beginning that it's a bit of an evolving space and it's a controversial sort of area. I wanted to start with Peter Sawyer first. Peter, as a clinician, what are some of the terms that you've seen come back on the pathology report to describe these sorts of lesions? What kinds of things are we talking about here?
Yes, thank you so much. My background is a clinician, but also in Europe, I worked 20 years as dermatopathology at the Medical University of Graz. So there I get different answers in the reports in Europe and in Australia. Here in Australia, I very often get the diagnosis of dysplastic nevus and falling short of in-situ melanoma, which always makes me a little bit suspicious if this is not an over-definition, over-detection. But then there are also other terms which, for example, mel-tump, melanocytic tumor of uncertain malignant potential, which is particularly relevant for nodular pigmented lesions, which is a topic on its own right. I personally think this MELPAS system, which just recently has been restructured from 5 categories down to 4 categories, is a very relevant one. This takes care of the situation, dysplastic nevus early involving in-situ melanoma, minimal invasive melanoma, and this put all these 2 categories into one diagnosis. And there is obviously well known that there is quite a significant diagnostic disagreement among these 2 diagnostic categories.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to turn over to you, Andrew, now, and looking at a pathologist's point of view of things. In the past, we used to think that melanocytic lesions were really either benign or malignant. They could sort of fall into one of 2 camps. But this concept of borderline lesion, can you talk us through that? What's your understanding? What falls into that category?
Yeah, sure. So in pathology, for a long time, that's exactly right. There's been this push to dichotomize melanocytic lesions into either benign or malignant and all the management that will follow from conferring one of those diagnoses. The majority of lesions can be categorized, I think, with experience and with clinical history into benign or malignant, but there is and will remain a group that shows some features of a benign lesion, but also some overlapping features of a malignant lesion, and these we call borderline. And I think it's important to distinguish borderline actually captures 2 types of uncertainty. There's one where actually Richard Scholar, and after Zembowitz wrote a really good paper in 2011 talking about melanocytomas. So there's one kind of borderline which is indeterminate, and that's where we just lack the ability to separate something into benign or malignant. I can give an example of one of those later. And then there's intermediate, where there is a true biological intermediate behavior between benign and malignant, and melanocytoma is the word that captures that. So I think over time, with experience, pathologists for a long time realized there are some melanocytic lesions that are not completely benign, not completely malignant, have this intermediate behavior, and now we've conferred a name or suggested this name, melanocytoma, to capture that.
Andrew, just getting back to those indeterminate lesions that you're talking about, you mentioned that there's a number of factors there. What sort of factors might influence that outcome?
Absolutely. So histologically, there are some lesions. So a prototypical lesion would be a regenerating nevus. This is a benign lesion, but in the absence of clinical history of actually a previous excisional biopsy, the regrowing nevus can look quite histologically aggressive. It can have deep mitoses, it can have cytologic atypia, it can have asymmetry, it can have fibrosis. And so it shows a lot of the histologic features of malignancy, but not entirely. There's still some features, there's still benign areas. And it can be very difficult in histology alone to categorize that into benign or malignant. And that's an example where clinical history can really assist and will turn an intermediate lesion to a benign. So that's where changes have occurred that make it difficult for us to use histology alone to categorize into benign or malignant.
And we might ask Peter a little bit later about some of those other clinical factors that are important in the biopsy process. There's a category that's indeterminate, and there's a category that we think are now intermediate. Can you talk us through that some more? What are the sort of terms that are used there? What's the history of this, and how did we get to this point?
So the word meltump has come up a few times. I personally don't use the term meltump, and as Peter said, it stands for melanocytic tumor of uncertain malignant potential. They tend to be dermally based or compound lesions, which show some features that don't allow for easy categorization to benign or malignant. That was a term created some years ago to sort of rarefy or categorize the difficulty of putting lesions into benign or malignant. Said personally, we tend not to use that. Melanocytomas, or these biologically intermediate lesions, are different. They are recognizable entities that have particular appearances and particular immunohistochemical and molecular findings that allow them to be categorized separately and have a separate intermediate behavior. So they're not completely benign. They go to lymph nodes, so they metastasize to sentinel lymph nodes, but they tend to have long-term good behavior. Not always, but most of the time they tend to be, they tend to go to lymph nodes, but patients with these lesions tend to have long-term survival. Yeah.
Is this the group of lesions that we used to classify as the horse melanomas
or animal type? Yeah. That's the prototypical melanocytoma. The term we use now is pigmented epithelioid melanocytoma. Mm. That's right. Everyone remembers that's the horse melanoma, yep. Or hyperpigmented or animal type melanoma. So that's the prototype of the melanocytoma. For a long time, it was a recognizable lesion. It looks like a melanoma in many features. It doesn't mature with depth. It shows mitotic activity, has quite profound cytologic atypia. But over a long period of time, it was realized these lesions will metastasize sentinel lymph nodes, but behave quite well. And most patients who have these lesions do very well. Some of these patients also have a certain syndrome, which we won't get into. And from that, actually, that's why the word melanocytoma partially was chosen, because it came from pigmented epithelioid melanocytoma. So that's right. And that's the classic example of that intermediate biological behavior.
Peter, I might just ask for your input on this too. There's quite a number of different confusing terms in this space. How do you classify these things in your own mind when you...
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that in the last 20 years, a lot of development has happened in relation to this nodular pigmented lesions, right? Melanocytoma, and Andrew, you mentioned it quite clearly, these lesions who go to the deep dermis, often into the subcutis, are heavily pigmented. And there are a few names. When they're malignant, there's an animal type melanoma, which is one thing. If they're benign, they're called, for example, deep penetrating nevus is another terminology. And nowadays, since probably 2004, they have called melanocytoma. And interestingly enough, there's very often a molecular background to this. Unfortunately, in my career back in Austria, I have witnessed quite a few of these cases, and some of them with a very bad outcome, right? I recall definitely a lady who was age 17, clinically it looked like an unusual blue nevus. Histologically, then it was between deep penetrating nevus and animal type melanoma. It was probably in the early 90s. At this time, the term melanocytoma has not yet been used for this. And I recall at the pathology meeting and a big pathology meeting with all the experts worldwide, there were two camps. Yeah. One group was saying this is a deep penetrating nevus. The other was saying it's animal type melanoma. We did lymph node excision at this time. It didn't even sentinel lymph node didn't even exist. The lymph node were negative, but then 3 years later, she died on a metastatic melanoma. So it is a very complex issue because if a lesion is nodular and it is a melanoma, then of course the prognosis is bad. On the other hand, I fully agree with Andrew and with all the developments now in pathology and in molecular pathology, we are now definitely able to basically to define this group of melanocytomas. And having said this, we also have a few examples. I have one of my former patients who had a, nowadays for sure it would have been called a melanocytoma. Then we called it epithelioid blue nevus, but this was a little girl. She had lymph node metastasis, but she is fine after 25 years, right? So there's definitely this intermediate group. And I think it's something where the only thing what I think for cases like this, you definitely need very experienced pathologists in pathology reference centers to make the diagnosis and then do the molecular workup, which is nowadays available and possible.
So I just have a question for Andrew. The molecular changes, are they easily able to be ordered? And what are they, for example?
Yes. So, Robin, I think you're touching on some melanocytomas have clear molecular changes. And what's really nice about that is melanocytomas were recognized clinically and morphologically before we showed that quite nicely lined up with molecular changes. That I won't go into all the details, but for some of them, for example, the pigmented epithelial melanocytoma, we can do a stain in the lab called PRKAR1A, and loss of that stain will confirm that it's indeed a pigmented epithelial melanocytoma with deep penetrating nevi that have been mentioned. We can do a beta-catenin stain. So we have tools in the lab without recourse to more sophisticated genetic testing that can help the diagnosis of these melanocytomas, yeah.
And if they don't have those abnormalities, will the pathologist chase and do further genomic testing?
Potentially, again. And this is where clinical background is so helpful. If it's talking to a clinician, if this is a critical diagnosis, if this is going to be a bifurcation of their treatment pathway, if it's the difference between a sentinel node excision or something more severe, then we would potentially pursue more thorough molecular testing. And there are issues pursuing that in Australian laboratories, but there are ways. There are difficulties currently, but there are also avenues we can pursue to try to do more comprehensive testing.
Okay.
Can I ask a question to you, Andrew? The topic of Spitz nevus, right, and Spitz tumor, is this now also subsummarized under the broader term of melanocytoma, or is this basically completely separated in the classic pathology knowledge of today?
No, actually, I think of the atypical Spitz tumor, actually, as an example of a melanocytoma. And they molecularly, again, will show not one, but two genetic changes, and they correlate quite nicely.
So I was actually thinking on this because we had to do a lot with this discussion of Spitz tumor, atypical Spitz tumor. And I think it makes sense now to lump this together under the broader term of melanocytoma. It's just that the classical melanocytoma as described originally were heavily pigmented, whereas obviously the Spitz tumors are often amelanotic.
I think I was confused with the evolving terminology, actually. So even doing this podcast has clarified my thinking about this term melanocytoma.
Actually, if I can go back to that, because I think the terminology is still quite confusing and it's filtering down, really. There are some that propose now that there's almost three categories. You've got benign lesions, you've got melanomas, and then everything in between should be some sort of melanocytoma that's being used as a category. But are we actually at that stage yet, or is that not how we should understand things, Andrew?
No, biologically, I think there is recognition that melanocytic lesions, like similar lesions in the gynecologic tract or in bone soft tissue pathology, that there are some lesions that truly show this, that are not benign and not malignant, they fall in between. But I guess I'll come back to what I said earlier. The borderline diagnosis is more than that. Borderline will encompass those that are biologically intermediate, but also, and probably much more commonly, those lesions that we cannot categorize because of clinical, because of like trauma, because of, I think, clinical factors. So like I said, the regenerated nevus, pregnancy, the presence of pregnancy, previous traumatization, irritation of lesion, problems in our lab. Maybe it's a very superficial sample. Maybe it's not fully sampled. They've done a shave biopsy of a larger lesion. So those aren't to do with, those actually aren't biological factors of the lesion. That's a limitation imposed by other factors that prevent us from categorizing something as benign or malignant.
In my way of thinking, there's a huge difference if the lesion is flat or is just slightly elevated versus a nodular lesion. Right? This is clinically clearly different. And if a flat lesion, in God's sake, if this is an incisor melanoma or severely dysplastic nevus or however you like to call it, the person will not die. Right? I mean, this is it is basically a benign lesion. However, a nodular lesion which goes into the deep reticular dermis, which goes into the subcutaneous fat, I think this is a completely different topic. And I think one needs to separate these two discussions, because at the end of the day, the superficial lesions are much more common in the daily world. Of course, in the highly specialized departments, you will also have a lot of these nodular deep lesions. But I think there are two different topics. But I would really like to hear your thoughts, Andrew and Robin, on this.
I was going to say that the diagnosis of borderline lesions is a fascinating topic, and we could talk about it for far too long. And I just wanted to make mention that there's an excellent video by Richard Scoyer, Andrew Detrick, and Nigel Marr called How to Diagnose Borderline Cutaneous Melanocytic Lesions. I watched it a few nights ago. It's 1.5 hours. It covers really nicely the histopathological approach to the diagnosis of borderline lesions. So I recommend people want a further discussion and really evaluation of this topic to look at that video. The link to this video will be in the attached show notes.
Peter's raised an interesting point there, the difference between the flat lesion and the nodular lesion clinically. I'm just wondering, Andrew, have you got any input on that one?
Peter mentioned the term SAMPUS, which is, you'll have to help me out, Peter, if I get it wrong, but superficially atypical melanocytic proliferation on a certain malignant potential. That captures the fact that... That captures the fact that lesions that are thin that haven't really invaded far into the dermis. There's a bit more flexibility in naming because their biologic behavior tends to be more on the benign end. So we know with melanomas, their thickness, their Breslow thickness, is strongly correlated with their malignant behavior. So thinner lesions, even if there's uncertainty to the atypia, surgical management will be definitive. And so in some regards, categorizing something as possibly malignant and superficial and malignant and superficial may not change the management that much. Maybe local management will change, and I'll defer to Robin with that. But in terms of surveillance, the metastatic risk, they're very low with superficial lesions. So they are a bit different. In the nodular category, where they're thick lesions, if they're malignant and if they're a mismalignancy, they can behave very aggressively. And so the stakes are higher in a sense for that categorization.
And can I just make here another comment? There's obviously a lot of discussion going on, and I just recently heard a lecture from David Elder on this topic, and they are now proposing quite a few new names for this, you know, zero-risk melanoma, ultra-low-risk melanoma, melanocytic neoplasm of low malignant potential, or melanocytic dysplasias. And all of these lesions fall into this MPAS-2 type of the MPAS classification. Yeah. And this is obviously a topic which is particularly relevant for the overdiagnosis of melanoma, for the topic of overdiagnosis, because in Australia we have 18,000-19,000 invasive melanoma a year, but 28,000 in cytomelanomas. And this has to do that there is obviously an overdefinition in the pathology world, I think, of the diagnosis in cytomelanoma, which is a different, completely different discussion to the one which we had on melanocytoma. It's really, we have a saying in Germany, it's an andere Baustelle, completely different topic. Yeah.
I have a slight, I guess, different view of these superficial lesions. So I agree with you, Peter, the whole whether something is melanoma in situ or not, that's a whole different discussion. We're talking about, I guess, potentially thin melanomas versus these nodular lesions that you've described. And from my point of view, if you give me a diagnosis of superficial melanoma, I still worry because the volume of them is high and they still, 10 years, 20 years down the track, may still die from their melanoma, and the volume is higher because there's so many of them. So I must admit I'm a little bit cautious and I have less of a view that the superficial lesions may not be so worrying.
Actually, Robin, I fully agree with you. And here we really have to go then much more into the topic, because one thing is the in situ melanoma and the other is the superficial level 2, level 3 melanoma, melanomas under 0.5. And it's, as you have mentioned, it's actually a certain percentage of people are dying on this thin melanomas. It seems that from a histopathologic point of view, there is then these lesions have a component of a vertical growth phase. And again, Elder has elaborated in this talk quite nicely that even within the area of the superficial melanomas, there are two different types. Those who have no vertical growth phase and no ulceration, and others who have this vertical growth phase. But you are absolutely correct. To the moment where the diagnosis is superficial melanoma level 2, let's say under 0.5, this is a different than if it's just these plastic needles falling short of in cytomelanoma and there is no invasive component documented. Having said this, of course, who knows what happens in serial sections and so on. And then there's another point, which is obviously quite close to my heart, is that now with all this imaging which we are doing, we have quite a few lesions where we have a clinical absence of dynamic changes. And actually, we have the lesion documented over 3 years, and the lesion didn't change, but then it was excised, and the diagnosis came out in cytomelanoma. And here, I think we have to obviously study much more about this. And this is one of the reasons why in our ASMID project, we have a pathology working group under the lead of Peter Ferguson, which you, Andrew, know probably very, very well. And quite a few pathologists from our universities and pathology institutes are basically involved, because what we want to do is basically have then consensus histopathologic diagnosis, pave the way for automatic artificial intelligence in pathology correlating with the clinical imaging. So particularly in this specific field, much interesting work can be done. But I fully agree with you, Robin. We have to be careful. And I also know over the decades, a few patients who literally died with a 0.4 malignant melanoma. Right? I mean, this is absolutely true.
Andrew, I'm wondering, I'm not sure if you can comment on this, but thinking about that space, is there anything coming in terms of the genetics of these lesions that may develop that we know about that may help us in the future to distinguish between the ones that might become more aggressive?
Just taking this borderline category as a whole, but there won't be a single test because, as we've discussed, there's a number of lesions that are intermixed and a number of scenarios that are intermixed amongst this borderline group. I will say in MIA, Richard Scollier and a few other investigators have been working on adjunct molecular tests to try to separate out some of these borderline lesions into benign or malignant using very sophisticated gene panels. So there's definitely work in the space. Others have tried expression arrays. There is quite a lot of work out there. Diagnostically, in a day-to-day fashion, we haven't found it greatly useful yet. For example, FISH testing, which is a type of molecular test, that was proposed as a useful adjunct in borderline lesions. Well, we used it in our lab for about 5 years, never found it very useful, didn't really add anything to the lesions that were borderline, didn't really help us separate them out into benign and malignant. So I think it's definitely an evolving area, that there are emerging tools that we will need time and experience to evaluate and use and see how useful they are, working with clinicians, seeing how they work with yeah.
But I think also that the bit that you're given is actually crucial. Right. So if you just have a 2 millimeter punch biopsy of a lesion or a little shave biopsy, that's not going to be as helpful as you had if you had the whole lesion to assess and test.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that comes back to some of these borderline lesions are a result of the diagnostic limitation of limited material. We just don't have enough tissue or enough of the sample to make a comprehensive diagnosis. And that type of borderline is different from the intermediate biological lesions we were talking about. So I feel like we've got a few different topics sort of intermingled together. But Robert makes it's an excellent point. Adequate sampling is really critical for diagnosis. Yeah.
And I guess that is something we do keep coming back to again and again. There's an interplay between the clinical and the pathology as well, too. Mm. And that it's vitally important to give the pathologist adequate clinical information and an adequate sample as well too.
And I often get asked whether I'm against shave biopsy. I am not, as long as it's a deep enough shave biopsy so that I have a dermis for you to diagnose the lesion. Mm. For me, the type of biopsy almost doesn't matter as long as it's big enough and deep enough.
And I fully agree with your comment, Robin. But it comes down to the skills of the person who does the biopsy. And one has also to take into consideration what body size you do the biopsy. So if a skilled clinician does a shave biopsy on a flat lesion, I think there's nothing wrong with it. But of course, if then you do a shave biopsy of a nodular lesion, and you do just a superficial shave, it's very, 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 very bad, right? Or what some colleagues do is the lesion is a 5-6 millimeter lesion, then they do a 2 millimeter punch biopsy, which is also not the way to go. So, but having said this, I witnessed over the years that the skill level of the clinicians is improving in this context.
Getting an adequate biopsy for me means that the pathology report is much more helpful for me as a clinician at treating these lesions. Because if the pathologist, like we're talking about the two groups of these borderline lesions, so maybe I'll go to the melanocytomas first. Because there is a sense that they're definitely not melanoma now, my treatment of these is kind of intermediate. So we actually do have to explain these to the patients. And they're happy to receive this explanation. They don't like it, that you can't tell them that it's definitely a melanoma or not, but reassured that it's not a melanoma. Secondly, what I mean by treating them in not quite like a melanoma is that I would still normally recommend that they have a slightly wider excision, and I tend not to do a sentinel node biopsy anymore because they're not melanomas, but I may choose to lymphatic map these and monitor the sentinel nodes with ultrasound. And I may be being aggressive, but I actually monitor the sentinel nodes with ultrasound for about 10 years just to ensure that we're keeping an eye on the nodes, and I would still see the patients as per my usual melanoma follow-up protocol.
Just on the detail of that follow-up, Robin, you say you do that for 10 years. How often would you do that?
So I usually see them more often in the first couple of years. So 2 years, maybe 4 to 6 monthly, and then 6 monthly to the 5-year anniversary, and then yearly after that. These patients are usually young. The youngest that I've seen is 11 for these melanocytoma patients. So it's a long time to be seeing them, but I guess I'm more reassured that I'm the one following them up rather than someone who may not be as aware of the subtleties of these lesions.
We no longer do sentinel lymph nodes biopsies, as you said, but retrospectively, there may be patients who previously have had sentinel node biopsies and they've found to be involved and they've had not just ultrasounds, but that they've had scans done. What's your approach with those sort of patients and with continuing scans or not continuing scans?
So as we've learnt more about these melanocytomas, I know Peter's said that he's had a patient or two who have metastasized systemically, but on the whole, I guess these patients don't tend to. I must admit, I don't recommend full body staging scans, PET scans, brain scans, unless there is a clinical reason to do it, so symptoms.
Can I just make a comment? Actually, Robin, we have also had in Graz quite a few patients, what we call atypical spitz nevi, which then also some of them had lymph nodes, metastasis, but they are living over 10, 20 years and it's all fine. We didn't use then, obviously, the term melanocytoma, but I fully agree with this. I think the two patients which I have in mind, at the end of the day, they were not melanocytomas, they were animal type melanomas, mimicking deep penetrating nevi or mimicking melanocytoma, right? So at the end of the day, the diagnosis in this case is was an animal type melanoma. But I completely agree with you that one has to be very conservative in the management to do a re-excision, of course. And I think I like also the idea that you are doing with sonography of the lymph nodes, which is not every center is doing this, but at the end of the day, it's certainly something which makes definitely a sense because it's easy to do and it's peace of mind for the patient, but also for the clinician.
So I'd like to ask, we talked about the two categories. We've got this new concept of the intermediate lesion, but also there's those indeterminate lesions that probably fall into one camp or the other. We just can't categorize those accurately yet, and you get a report coming back that reflects that. How do we manage that? What do you do with that, Robin?
So it's actually very difficult, and I understand the pathologist's difficulty in giving me a definitive diagnosis of whether something is benign or whether it's a melanoma, particularly with the limitations of the biopsies as we've discussed, and also, you know, trauma to the lesions. It is difficult, I realize, but at the end of the day, we still have to treat the patient and we still have to tell them and manage them appropriately. So it's actually difficult. They really want a diagnosis. So when I discuss this with the patients, I actually tell them that, you know, in fact, it's probably not terrible because it's not definitely a melanoma. And so your risk of definite possible metastatic disease is not necessarily there. So they're a little reassured by that, but it is difficult to explain to the patient that we still don't yet have the technology, the science to diagnose this.
So one aspect too is to request a formal pathology review, and I understand that there's even an item number in Australia, and there is this melanoma histopathology reference center in Sydney, but I also send it to our local pathologist here at the Bay, to Duncan Lambie. So this is one aspect. The other aspect is, of course, if a person has an indeterminate lesion, I look at the whole clinical aspect, and if this person has several other moles, so for me, this person is still a sort of a high-risk melanoma person, and I like to follow up these persons clinically, of course, now with total body imaging. But I really, because I recall that a few of my former patients with indeterminate lesions, they then developed years later a real melanoma on another body site. So there's certainly, let's say, as I like to think, a genetic position for this. So it's certainly a very complex topic, but I really think, as you mentioned, Robin, we have full disclosure to our patients, discuss this with them, do if necessary a small local re-excision. But I also like to get an independent pathology review in specific cases. I give you an example. A 12-year-old girl with 3 incisor melanoma within 6 months and terrible scars, right? Hypertrophic scars. Of course, then I discussed it with the father. We sent it to Richard. It came back. There are no melanomas. Still, she's a high-risk person. I still follow her up, and she well may develop a melanoma later in life. But I think it is important to get the pathology reviewed by experts. And we are lucky in Australia to have quite a few excellent dermatopathologists.
And with management of these patients, when I see them face-to-face, have to explain the pathology. And then I go through with the patients what they would have been treated as if this was a true melanoma. So dependent on their thickness, dependent on their central node positivity risk, as Peter said, a slightly wider excision, but also related to the central node biopsy. I still put the possible thickness in the central node risk calculator. And if it is actually a moderate risk, so greater than 10%, I might actually suggest lymphoscintigraphy and again, ultrasound monitoring of their central nodes. So treating them as if they're almost a melanoma, but I would not choose to do a central node biopsy on these patients.
Thank you everyone for your time today. We might just end with one last question. What does the future hold, do you think, as we look at this space? It's obviously an evolving space. There's a lot that we don't yet know. Where do you think we're headed to?
So I think overall, there will always remain an uncertain category. And discussions like this, talking about how to manage uncertain patients, these will always occur. And I think there'll be gradual refinement over time. In terms of indeterminate lesions, so small biopsies that have problems with interpretation, I think there will be more and more adjunctive tests that pathologists can use to try to separate out cases. Again, it won't work for every case, but I think, again, over time, there'll be cases in which we will be able to use other tests to separate them out or suggest these are more likely to behave in a malignant or benign fashion. With intermediate, so melanocytomas, I think the terminology is becoming more mature, and now we're in the process of disseminating these terms to clinicians and other doctors, general practitioners, because these terms are in the World Health Organization manual that pathologists use. But I think for those who aren't working in the pathology space, perhaps that there'll be some time becoming familiar with these terms and reports, coming to education sessions, potentially listening to things like this.
It's going to take 10 years,
yeah.
Andrew.
and I think over time, again, perhaps there will be further categories that there are emerging intermediate biological lesions. They're rare. There will probably be a few additional categories added to our diagnostic armamentarium.
And Peter, do you have any comments at all?
Yeah, there have been exciting developments in this field in the last 20 years, and there are certainly more to come on various levels in regard to the germline genetics of high risk of persons, in regard to the molecular genetics of individual lesions with spatial transcriptomics. Artificial intelligence will kick in also in pathology. But I think the most important point is, and this is what we have lived today, is a discussion among the various disciplines, right? This kind of multidisciplinary approach, because at the end of the day, this is in the interest of our patient that we speak together. And in this spirit, I really enjoyed our panel discussion today.
Well, thank you, Peter. Thank you, Andrew. And thank you, Robin, for a really fascinating discussion in quite a difficult area there. And I think that really highlights the value of having a multidisciplinary team to discuss some of these more difficult issues, as we've looked at those two broad categories of the indeterminate lesion and how we best come to a diagnosis and how we manage some of the uncertainty around that. And also the interesting evolving category of that true intermediate lesion, many of which are now encompassed under that evolving category of melanocytoma, lesions that we think are genetically characterized by the presence of a second driver mutation. And on presentation clinically, they may display some quite alarming characteristics, histologically, they can be quite concerning. Clinically, they can be quite concerning. We know that some of them even have deposits in regional lymph nodes, but we now know that despite that, in terms of biological behavior, by and large, they typically pursue a very benign clinical course, and though some occasionally do become aggressively malignant. And we've now realized that lymph node biopsy, sentinel node biopsy, is not really appropriate in those patients anymore. And for our patients that fall into that category, we can now give them a significant degree of reassurance regarding their prognosis. But at the same time, we've mentioned both for those patients and the indeterminate patients, we do need to balance that with an appropriate degree of clinical vigilance as well.
Thanks, Adrian, Andrew, Robin and Peter for providing some clarity around that challenging topic. You have been listening to Melanoma Insights for Professionals, brought to you by Melanoma Institute Australia and made possible by unrestricted educational grants from Merck Sharp & Dohme Pharmaceuticals, Bristol Myers Squibb and Heine. I'd also like to acknowledge that this recording was done on Cammeraygal land. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please share it with a friend or colleague and be sure to leave us a review. For more practice-changing education, sign up to our Melanoma Education portal at melanomaeducation.org.au. Thanks for listening.